Okay, thank you so much. It's a tremendous privilege to be here with you. It's always great to spend time here at Torah Shraga. It's always great to spend time here in Israel. I just got here yesterday. It's really a tremendous contrast to be in America at the end of December and to be in Israel in anticipation of Hanukkah. You walk the streets of the United States at this time of year, and you are saturated in the world of the secular holiday season, and then you arrive in Israel, and everywhere you go and everywhere you look, you are confronted with the realities of the coming Chag of Hanukkah. And it's amazing, because you walk down the street, and you see donuts everywhere with like 3 feet high frostings. You see latkes cooking outside the stores everywhere. People on street corners just drinking oil straight out of the can. It's like the Jews react to anti-Semitism by just killing themselves. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And one of the most exciting opportunities that I have in Hanukkah is we get our family together, we all come together, and we love the foods of Hanukkah. We love the latkes, we love the donuts, and my absolute favorite food of Hanukkah is those chocolate money coins, right? All year round, we tell our children, do not eat money, right? My daughter once, when she was 4 years old, swallowed a penny on Shabbos. She comes up to me, she's like, I swallowed a penny, I don't know what to do. I'm like, you're a muksa, I can't touch you, I can't. My wife's like, stop talking to the children, just stop talking to them, right? So we all year round, we're like, don't touch money, don't eat money, and then on Hanukkah, we're like, hey, the Jews won a war, let's eat money, right? It's a little on the nose in terms of the character of the Jews, right? But okay, that's how we celebrate. But these are really one of the most unique culinary objects ever created in the history of man. They come in a titanium sealed casing. I don't know if you've ever had one of these chocolate coins, especially the Chol of Yisrael ones, which have the beard hair kind of coming out of the middle. They come in this titanium sealed coin, and you have to have a nail prepared from before Hanukkah. If you cut all your nails before Hanukkah, you will die of starvation over this holiday. Assuming you have a nail, you find the one vulnerable spot on this coin. You stick your nail in between the metal casing and the chocolate coin, and you bend it backwards. After the tetanus shot, you remove the top of the coin. It is now exposed in your hand, and it is covered by a very mysterious white powder, which on any other food would result in an international recall for listeria. But this is what it is. So you blow off the anthrax, and you're left with this piece of chocolate, which when you put into your mouth, has a chemical property that is different than any other piece of chocolate you've ever eaten in your life. It literally, chocolate, usually it melts, it combines, it coalesces. This thing brittles into 14,000 different little pieces and sucks the moisture out of parts of your mouth you did not know exist. Glands that you didn't even know you had start secreting all sorts of reactive and responsive enzymes in order to try its best to break down this substance into something digestible. And it's an amazing part of Hanukkah. We do it, we love it, it's amazing, it's tremendous. And the other part of Hanukkah that we love, of course, is the gifts. And I'm about to go back. I'm going back Thursday night. And every time I come to spend time here to speak in yeshivas, so I always try to get gifts for my kids. And usually I leave it for the very end. In fact, last summer we came to Israel as a family. And when we were leaving, we're all in Ben Gurion Airport. My kids walk into the Steinmetzkis and they look around at all these souvenirs and they're like, we have all this stuff. We have every stuffed camel, even the Christian plates we have. My kids are from Passaic. I'm like, these are just geometrical shapes. It's not, you know, just a lot of right angles that celebrates Masada. Don't worry about it. It's fine. It doesn't have Yom HaTzimut. Everybody's fine. It's amazing. So I try to buy gifts for my kids. So a few years ago, I might have even shared this story once here. A few years ago, I was walking down the street in Mea Shearim, and I love Mea Shearim. It reminds me of Teaneck. And I'm walking down the street in Mea Shearim, and there are stores everywhere, and I'm looking for my gift to buy my kids. And finally I see there's this huge toy store, and there's a bin right in front of it, and they have all these little figurines, and I don't know if you've seen these things, like, they make now like little toys of like fathers and mothers and children. They come in a set of like 15, and they have all sorts of like tzitzis, and they have skirts, and they have aprons, and they have toy kitchens, and toy kolels, and toy kolel checks, and food stamps. So there's all these different things in the thing, and we're all together, so I'm looking through all these toys, and finally I pull out of the bin, I promise you, it's 100% true story, you can ask Rabbi Schwartzberg, he was with me, and I pull out of the bin a toy Santa Claus. So I walk up to the Hasidic guy who's running the store, and I say to him, Rabid, which I don't know what that means, but I was like, Rabid, and then in my full yeshiva high school Hebrew, Mazeh, right? Which is like the dialect that says, rip me off right now, right? Mazeh. So the guy looks at me totally seriously and he says to me, Ze Chanukah Rav. So I said to him, Sebo Chanukah Rav. Ze Saint Nicholas, right? There's no Hasidus that has a red Bekesha, right? Even if there was a third break off from Bubble, it wouldn't be in a red Bekesha. There's no Hasidus with a red Bekesha. So, you know, Hanukkah's like, it's in Israel, it's everywhere. Right? Back and forth, you're walking around. It's an amazing experience. You don't even appreciate that as the Chagim arrive, the degree to which you are totally immersed in the experience, in the living of the energy of what it means that a chag is coming and what it does for you. And it's an amazing, incredible experience. But there's another very fundamental difference that you're going to see between the Hanukkah you remember from your home and the Hanukkah that you will experience here in your home in Israel. And that is, most of us in America light the menorah where? Inside the home. What you are going to see in Israel is that many, many people, if not most people, but not all people, light their menorah where? Outside on the street. Why is that so? So the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that the proper, authentic location for the menorah, as it was originally conceived by Chazal, as an expression of the pride and the confidence that emerged in the aftermath of the Hanukkah storm, is Bachutz, the Gemara says. Near Hanukkah Bachutz, it's supposed to be outside. There's supposed to be a certain sense of inner resolve and confidence that we're projecting to the world around us, that we have pride in Rabin Biyad Me'atim, in the miracle in the Nes of Hanukkah. However, says the Gemara, that Mipnei HaSakona, there are periods in Jewish history where the Jewish people are susceptible to persecution, to attack, they are vulnerable to being infiltrated by their enemies, says the Gemara, when it is happening, Bizman HaSakona, the Gemara says, then you light Al Shulchano on your table, Vidayo, and that's enough. They move the lighting of Hanukkah from outside the home towards inside the home. And the Rishonim discuss, what exactly was this Sakona? Some Rishonim say there was a special edict that candles can only be lit for ritual purposes in a Beis Avodah Zarah. It's hard for us to relate to even what a Beis Avodah Zarah is. We don't live in a world where people worship idols. It's hard for us to even relate to it. I have three daughters. There's something called an American Girl doll, which is the closest you could probably get. But we can't even relate to this concept. But that's what it was. Some Rishonim say that it was a iser on people lighting Hanukkah menorahs in their home. That the nations that surrounded the Jewish people at that time, for them, it was intolerable that the Jewish people could express this kind of majestic confidence in who they are, and their identity, and their future, and their heritage. And so there was a gezeira, there was a sakana, that they were not permitted to light the menorah in the home at all. The Meiri writes, it was a gzeira against all mitzvos. There are different reasons that account for what this sakana was. But the real question is, when the Gemara presents this, it sounds from the Gemara
like the sakana was a circumstantial situation. It was a response, a reaction to a reality at a particular point in time. Because there was a sakana, they moved the menorah inside. And once the sakana had abated, once there's no more danger, one would imagine that the menorah should then move back outside. Yet the Rishonim already raised, or Zaruah and others already raised the question that they look around their communities and they see that even though they are not living in a period of sakana, people are still lighting the menorah inside their home. Right? I live in New Jersey. I live in New Jersey because sometimes God does bad things to good people. And living in New Jersey, it is totally safe 100% for me to light my menorah outside. Nothing's going to happen to me. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen when the non-Jews see you lighting a menorah outside? Let me tell you something. For what's supposed to be 8 days, but usually turns out to be about 2.5 months, there is a very precarious and dangerous non-zoned wooden hut that sits on my driveway with a covering of bamboo, which is installed by yeshiva guys who've probably been kicked out, all sorts of upside down boards, everything's like sort of nailed together, doesn't bother anybody. In New Jersey, the only thing I have to do to be a good citizen is I have to contribute my share of toxic fumes to the overall environment. As long as I am part, many states have a state bird or a state flag, we have a state odor. And everybody has to give their fair share. As long as I'm part, nobody cares, it's not a danger, nothing's going to happen if I light my menorah outside my home. So why don't we move it back outside? Why is it that I light my menorah inside and most people in America, most people in the Golah light their menorahs inside? So a great debate in Halacha emerged as to whether or not this transition of moving the menorah inside the home was a transition that essentially was precipitated by a circumstance, but ultimately codified as a restructuring of the mitzvah itself, which is the opinion of some. And therefore, we continue to light inside the home. And even when the Jews returned to Israel, there were those who are uncomfortable with the notion of lighting outside the home, even though there's certainly no reason to worry and have sakana, and it's our home, and it's our land, and it's our place, a famous Devar Yoshua. And then there were others that felt that, no, this is really all based on circumstance. If the circumstances are there, it should be inside. If they're not there, they should be outside. But the question continues. Why is it that in the Minhag Yisrael, HaShulchan already talks about the Minhag Yisrael, most homes, certainly outside of Eretz Yisrael, continue to light the menorah inside. Why is this compromise become part and parcel, have embedded in the standard observance of this mitzvah? So I want to suggest a different perspective, a different vantage point, from which we can approach the notion of moving the menorah from outside to inside. See, in life, whenever we encounter challenging circumstances that require us to compromise, to adjust, to adapt, to treat a certain situation with a different approach, there are two ways to look at it. One way to look at it is that there is a towering ideal. And anything that results in diminishing our engagement or our observance of the towering ideal is an erosion of our success. There is perfection, and when we encounter perfection, we're living an ideal, and if for some reason circumstances emerge that perfection is unreachable, then we are essentially moving further and further and further away from that ideal. Our direction is one of diminishment. And that's what circumstances are in life. We would all love to be towering Talmidei Chachamim. We have challenges in reaching that, and so that's the ideal. And if you're further away, you're a dilution of the ideal. That's one way to view challenge. The other way to view it is the way the Bach raises in this particular sugya. The Bach says, I don't understand. Hold on, let's take a step back here. If we're dealing with an era of Jewish history where there's persecution, where there's danger, so we know the halacha is when there's a clash between our safety and well-being and the observance of mitzvahs, which one loses, which one loses, which one wins, we know. Our well-being, our safety, right? In my shul, I have members of Hatzol, right? If somebody, his health is put in a compromised situation, these five guys, they throw up, it's the most dramatic thing you've ever seen, they throw up the sidurim, throw up the talasim, go running out of the shul with the keys bouncing, knock over four people, the next four Hatzol guys come and pick them up off the floor, jump into the ambulance, sirens down the block, knocking over cones, everybody's having a good time. Right? And the ladies in the back of that Sullivan, she's like, I'm telling you, this splinter, if I don't get this out before Shabbos is over, I'm going to get an infection. Right? Why do we do this? Why do we violate Shabbos? We violate Shabbos because if there's even a chance that someone's going to ultimately be hurt or killed, God forbid, that takes precedence over Shabbos. So says the Bach, I don't understand if the circumstances of history are such that the Jewish people are in danger, they are vulnerable. Then what should have the response been to this sakon? What should they have done? They should have eliminated the lighting altogether. What do you do? You are literally playing with fire. Literally. You are lighting a candle in the home. It could be seen from the outside. It could be, they could end up in your house. People could knock on the door and just walk in. You have no idea what's going to happen. So why wouldn't they eliminate the whole thing altogether? So says the Bach, the fact that they didn't eliminate the whole thing altogether, that's the Chiddush. The Chiddush is that it's even on the table inside the home. Because that's the other way to look at challenge and compromise. The other way to look at it is not that there's this ideal that we are eroding, but to recognize that sometimes in life, circumstances present themselves that in theory, if you wanted to, you could ascribe total abdication of your responsibility altogether. It's hard. It's hard for me. My mind doesn't work that way. My experiences, my background, my parents, my siblings, my school, my personality, my proclivities, my soul. It's hard. It's hard. And you could look at all of that and you could say, so you know what? If it's hard and if it's too difficult and there's no idea, then we'll just stay on the ground floor. We won't move at all. Or you could take the Hanukkah approach. What's the Hanukkah approach? Hanukkah is different than all the other Chagim. All the other Chagim celebrate victory and achievement. Celebrate walking out of Mitzrayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's providence over our sukkahs, receiving the Torah. Hanukkah is about a bunch of Jews walking into a Beis HaMikdash that was defiled and vandalized and rendered entirely unusable, and they would have had every right to walk right out and say, lighting the menorah? We haven't even started thinking about lighting the menorah. We got to get this place fixed up. We got to deal with what we have to deal with. We don't have to light a menorah. Look at what's going on, says the Gemara. The most important word in that whole Gemara, bodku. That's not what they did. Because these were Jews that when they faced overwhelming odds of physical destruction, overwhelming odds of spiritual destruction, they summoned from within themselves the courage and the tenacity and the bravery to be able to move forward. And so Badku, they searched that mikdash top to bottom until they found this tiny little piece of oil, which wasn't enough to light the menorah properly. And they didn't say to themselves, well, if we can't do this right, we can't do it at all. Let's spend the next 8 days making more oil. They took the vat of oil and they lit the menorah for light number one. Hanukkah is about walking in to compromise and challenge and setting yourself in a trajectory, in a direction that moves upwards. It views goals in life as not defining expectations that you're constantly falling short of. It views goals in life as a directional momentum that from the ground up, you find within yourself the strength and the ability and the focus and the hard work to ultimately reach what you're trying to get. And so lighting the menorah inside Mipnei HaSakana was not just a compromise. Lighting the menorah inside was a symbol and a manifestation of the entire nature of what Hanukkah is about. That even when things are hard, we light that candle inside. And this polarity exists in the machlokas of how to light candles itself. Beis Shammai says, how many candles do we light on the first night? 8! We're all used to the last night of Hanukkah. Last night of Hanukkah is the most exciting night of Hanukkah. You get everybody together. There are a million candles. They burn down very fast. There's always one guy who loves fire, and he's got like a gasoline menorah with propane coming out and fireworks and things going on. Last night of Hanukkah, it's like when Hanukkah starts, most sur is like the sweetest, most nostalgic. You like love it. Oh, it's a sur. And then you have 8 days of people putting this song to everything. Every Hallel, every Kedusha, people come out of the bathroom, Asher Yotzar, the Mosur Mamish, coming out of your ears. By the time Hanukkah is over, you want to put it into Kinos. You're like, you've had so much, just had enough of this song. Since the 8th night of Hanukkah, the glory of seeing all the, that's not Beis Shammai's menorah. Beis Shammai's menorah is you start with the ideal, says the Maharal. You put it all on the field. And then there's an inevitable reality. The inevitable reality is that life encroaches upon that vision of perfection for almost everybody. You can't live in the Kodesh HaKadosh. Life encroaches. You start with 8 because you put it all on the field. And then you can't keep 8 every night. Doesn't work. That's life. Life is 8 turns to 7 turns to 6 and you end the Chag at 1. A dilution of the original experience. But that's not Beis Hillel. Beis Hillel, the way we light the menorah, is Mosif V'Holi. The way we light the menorah is we start with 1, and then we ascend. We reach, we aspire, we grow. We have a direction, we have a momentum, we're headed upwards. And that's what Hanukkah is about. Hanukkah is about a certain sense of momentum, that miracles are challenging, that creating a new reality is challenging. That we don't look at life, that if we don't start at perfection, and then anything we don't do to measure up to that perfection is a failure, we look at life as there is a goal on top that we're trying to reach, but we start right here on the floor. And every light that we add is meaningful and purposeful and impactful and amazing and has within it the capability of allowing us and empowering us to illuminate greater meaning and purpose in our lives. That's the mosif v'holeich. That's why we light inside. We light inside because inside wasn't a compromise of the idea. Inside was actually a representation of the Jewish people and their resilience and their opposition to allowing people around them to define their reality. Inside says, we're moving up, not we're moving down. We're Mosif V'Holich. And this is what we try to do in life. We try to grow. We try to move up. And it takes time. Miracles take time. It doesn't happen just like that. That's the Beis Shammai menorah. You have to build. You have to build the menorah. I had an amazing experience a year ago. A year ago, I was asked to give a shiur about Hanukkah in a community called Linden, New Jersey. And I walk into the shul, and I was very familiar with the shul because my great-grandparents founded the Orthodox shul in Linden, New Jersey. And their children were not necessarily Shomer Shabbos. Those were my grandparents, amazing people. My grandfather fought in D-Day. My grandmother used to collect snowballs during the winter and put them in the freezer. And when we would come from L.A. for the summer, she'd take them out and we'd all have snowball fights in the middle of July. It was amazing. And they were incredible and they were amazing, but they lived a different life. And then their children eventually found Torah and Mitzvot, and their children have taken on leadership positions in the Jewish people. And I went to give a shiur in this community. After the shiur, people came to the shiur who knew my grandparents. It's so nice to see. Wow, the grandson. And after the shiur, they asked me if I want to daven Maariv with them. So I said, sure. So I go into the main shul to daven Maariv. And I sit down in a seat. And I look in front of me at the chair. And it says, Chernatsky, which is the name of my great-grandfather. I was in his chair. And while I was supposed to be focused on Maariv, I could not shake the vision in my head of my Zayn, my great-grandfather, sitting in this spot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Shabbos, davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, look, I built you a shul. I built you a community. I built you a reality. Help me inspire my kids. Help me. What's going on? How do we lose this? What's going on? I need to see the nachas of Torah, the nachas of growth. And feeling like, I don't know. Where's the miracle? Where's the reward? Where's the response? And I'm sitting in this chair and I'm thinking to myself, and here is his great-grandson, davening Maariv in his seat, after just having given a shiur to his entire community. Miracles take time. Growth takes time. It takes effort. It takes the incremental sustaining of investment, of self, of sacrifice, of energy. The ikar is not whether or not we're working with perfection. The ikar is whether or not we wake up every morning and say to ourselves, Mosif the Holich. I'm going to add one. Today, I'm going to add one. It's going to be in Midos, it's going to be in Davening, it's going to be in learning, it's going to be in Yerushamayim, it's going to be in my devotion to Eretz Yisrael, it's going to be in how I relate to my family. This day, I'm going to add one. Mosif the Holich. That's Chanukah. Chanukah is an entire 8 days to model, to look at the candles as they grow and ask ourselves what we are doing to nurture and cultivate within ourselves a trajectory of growth and the decisions that we are making about our life so that this experience doesn't just become a representation of the ideal that we strive every day afterwards to keep up with, but that it becomes a foundation from which additional candles can be lit, additional energy can be projected, additional illumination can be brought, that we can be mosif the whole, that we can continue to grow. I'm very blessed to teach Torah in a yeshiva that spends an enormous amount of time and effort on mosif the whole. And mosif aholeich in giving people the tools to be able to make a parnasa properly, and on mosif aholeich as a ben tov. And wherever you find yourself, whatever environment we find ourselves, whatever we end up going, whatever we end up doing, this is our avodah to find environments and opportunities that give us the chance to add another candle, that give us the chance to expand our reach and our impact on ourselves and on the world around us. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.